Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Mary McDougall and I'm delighted to welcome today's guest, who for many of you will need no introduction, economist and former civil servant Lord McPherson. Nick joined the Treasury in 1985 and served as Permanent Secretary to the Treasury from 2005 to 2016, spanning Gordon Brown, Alistair Darling and George Osborne's tenures as Chancellor. He managed the department through the financial and wider economic crisis, which began in 2007. Nick is currently Chairman of Halls Bank and a non-executive director of both British Land and Scottish American Investment Trust. Today, Nick is going to help us understand what happened over the last economic crisis, what worked and what didn't in the aftermath, and how he thinks policymakers should tackle the uncharted territory we find ourselves in today. Nick, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, you were the top civil servant in the Treasury over the global financial crisis. From an economic perspective, what are the most instructive things you learned from that period?
I think in a crisis, you've got to be prepared to be quite radical. I think with hindsight, we may have been a little bit too cautious in the Treasury back in 2008. And the critical thing is for the state to intervene in these circumstances to support the economy, or in the case of 2008, keep the banking system going. And inevitably in these situations, you're dealing in, you're making policy under conditions of uncertainty. It's always all very clear after the event when you can look at the statistics and indeed critique the policy response. At the time, you have very little information about what's really going on at the current time indeed. So in my view, if you can get your policy response about sort of two-thirds right, you're doing very well indeed. But in that respect, actually, I think the authorities this time around last year actually acted really quickly. I think learning the lessons potentially of the 2008 crisis. And so to that extent, the Bank of England and the Treasury, Mr. Sunak, should be congratulated.
So in terms of where we're at now, mechanisms to support the economy include monetary and fiscal policy. Let's start with the monetary side. The Bank of England has cut interest rates and issued a large QE programme, quantitative easing having been introduced in the last crisis. What are your views on QE now? I noted that you said 4 years ago QE was like heroin. You need ever-increasing fixes to create a high. Meanwhile, the negative side effects increase. Do you think it might have gone too far? And what are the negative side effects?
When I say it's like heroin, what I guess I mean is that in 2008, 2009, when I think quantitative easing began, long-term interest rates were still quite high. The government was borrowing over a 10-year period at a rate of something like 4.5%. As we went into this crisis, long-term interest rates were incredibly low. My recollection is that they were around sort of 1%, if that. And so you really do have to ask, well, what is quantitative easing going to achieve in those circumstances? And if really the objective is just to get long-term interest rates down from, 1% to 0.6%, and to do that, you have to do literally hundreds and hundreds of billions of quantitative easing. You do have to ask how effective it's likely to be as a policy tool. Now, I think the Bank of England's response last spring was perfectly sensible, lowering interest rates and doing more QE. But I guess what worries me is two things. There's a point when interest rates become so low that the banking system itself becomes impaired. Now, I should declare a bit of an interest. I chair a small private bank, as you mentioned. Nevertheless, when interest rates become very low indeed, banking becomes a pretty unprofitable activity, and the risk is that banks will actually lend less rather than more. So there's a risk there. But I think there's a second problem, which is that there is just so much money now sloshing around the system. Policy is so loose that I'm not a monetarist. I don't sort of believe there is some pure link between money and inflation. But I do think, and no doubt we can come on to some of the wider issues underpinning it, the risk of inflation has increased. Indeed, that is reflected in the fact that inflation keeps coming in higher than the Bank of England itself is forecasting. So I think the bank was sensible to intervene last year, but I'm slightly surprised that they are so reluctant to withdraw some of that stimulus. And my view of the coronavirus crisis is actually primarily this has been a supply side problem created by the virus itself. And actually, the most effective economic intervention at the moment is actually getting the virus sorted out, getting on top of it, rolling out the vaccine. Yes, there have been important interventions, I think, by the government to keep the furlough scheme going, supporting business, and so on. So I don't have a problem with greater fiscal support in the short run. Indeed, I think that's got to do the heavy lifting. I just wonder whether monetary policy needs to play quite such an advanced role.
Turning to fiscal policy and drawing it back to the last crisis, austerity was one of the policies in the aftermath of 2008, introduced to shrink the debt, and its success has been a matter of sharp debate. I think lots of people think it was not a success. What did you think about austerity measures at the time they were introduced, and what do you think about them now?
Well, I may reflect my intrinsic sort of bias as a former Treasury official. I do worry about the size of the nation's debt, and the problem. Certainly over my adult life with borrowing is it's possible for the state to carry on borrowing without any obvious sort of harm in terms of the impact on the wider economy. And indeed, it can do some good if it is supporting economic activity. The problem, I think, historically has always been that there have been inflection points where suddenly if you as a country are seen as an outlier, that can have really quite negative consequences, either in terms of the impact on long-term interest rates or an impact on sterling, e.g. through sort of devaluation and so on. So in 1976, for example, when the government was borrowing far less than it is now, it ended up having to borrow from the IMF, which was a difficult experience. And indeed, in the early 90s, with our exit from the ERM, I think that also was a comment on the credibility of the government's sort of wider economic policy. So you have to be alert to that. And I think austerity was, I think actually it was a term coined by David Cameron, but I think it sort of came back to bite his administration. Yes, Cameron and Osborne sought to reduce the deficit, but if you actually look at what happened in practice, it wasn't hugely different from what Labour were proposing at the 2010 election. It was a fairly steady consolidation of the deficit. You may criticise some of the measures, for example, cutting poor people's benefits, but that was a matter of political choice. There were lots of other options they could have implemented. So I think, it's always important for the government to have a plan. When a deficit has increased a lot, it kind of needs to be able to reassure the markets and indeed the electorate, that it has a plan at least to stabilize the level of debt in relation to the nation's income. And so, anyway, I'm probably in a minority. I think the fiscal policies of the Conservative Party the coalition government after 2010 had a certain logic. I would perhaps take issue of the instruments the government, the levers the government chose to pull. And actually, for much the same reason, I very much hope that at some point Mr. Sunak will set out a plan of how he is going to stabilise the nation's debt, because we have been borrowing a lot. Fortunately, the economy is recovering, so some revenues are beginning to come in. So the deficit's coming in a bit lower than expected. Nevertheless, I think that when we reach a steady state in the on the economy, we will find we've got a much bigger deficit than when we entered the coronavirus crisis. And so I hope that the government will be able to set out how it will, it doesn't have to balance the books, but it does need to show that debt will not continue to rise inexorably year by year in relation to national income. And the reason for that is that other countries will be addressing their debt problems. And Britain doesn't have to be have a more rigorous policy than other countries, but it can't afford to be an outlier. People don't have to hold sterling in the way that they have to hold dollars. And so, as I say, I hope that, you know, either this autumn or in the spring, the government will set out a plan about what it's going to do. And I suspect that will involve some combination of higher taxes and lower spending.
Can a strategy be to simply inflate away the debt?
Well, it could do. It depends what your attitude towards inflation is. I do think there is. I mean, I don't want to bring morality into the conversation, because I think that's always dangerous. But I do think the government has a obligation to try to maintain the value of the currency, the money people earn and save, because what is unfair about inflation is how it impacts different parts of the population differently. You know, if you're living on a fixed income or you've got a fixed level of savings and you find you've got lots of inflation, you suddenly become a whole lot poorer. Often, you know, at a time when you're retired and you haven't got actually the opportunity to go out and earn more money. Inflation, I mean, the other problem with inflation is it tends, if you really let it rip and you're prepared just to carry on printing money in a sense to pay for government spending, you can end up with a lot higher inflation than you expected. Now, I'm not claiming that Britain is anywhere close to going down the sort of Latin American or Turkish route, but it's something you need to keep an eye on. And there clearly are inflationary forces out there, some of which, I mean, many of which are to do with, some of which are to do with structural problems to do with coming out of the coronavirus itself, and which may be temporary, but some of those forces actually look rather more underlying. Some stem from Brexit. We can no longer rely on the Polish taxpayer to train much of our workforce. We've got to do it ourselves. And judging by the shortage of HGV drivers, we've got a bit of a problem there. And then you compound that with excess demand, and you might have a problem. Now, I'm not saying inflation is about to take off, but I do think the authorities just need to keep an eye on it. And I think a policy of just simply inflating away the debt is likely to have an impact on trust, because the people who buy your debts, assuming it's not your central bank, do kind of have to think that it's worth holding. And if your policy becomes just, well, we're just going to inflate it away, why on earth would anybody want to hold that debt? And at that point, you find that the price of borrowing, which in the end is determined by the market, not by the central bank, can actually turn against you. And that was part of the problem in the 1970s.
Now, I spoke to Russell Napier a few months ago, who called financial repression, which is another term for it, a surreptitious form of wealth tax.
It is. But at least a wealth tax, you know, you can really target your wealth tax on the people with huge amounts of wealth. I think inflation just is slightly more random in its incidence and in terms of whom it impacts. And that can impact on poor people as well as the wealthy.
Yeah. So we've talked about quantitative easing. We've talked about austerity. They're two very different things, but could be argued that both have driven inequality. Do you think this is true? And if so, what should be done about it?
Yes, it's an interesting issue. I do think certainly quantitative easing has had the consequence of pushing up asset prices. And you see that across the housing market. You see it particularly in the equity market. In a sense, if you can borrow for virtually nothing, why wouldn't you go out and buy assets? But the problem is, of course, that it's the asset rich who tend to benefit most from this policy. And now, in a sensible world, the government would take action. In a sense, to tax some of these excess capital gains which have arisen from QE, but the fact is the government hasn't done that. I don't blame the Bank of England for that. Actually, incidentally, I mean that is the government could have done something about it, and in itself, I don't think that is an argument against QE. I do think some of the distributional consequences of QE, and you also mentioned austerity, the way the government went about austerity, these are big issues, and it is important to maintain social cohesion, and the risk always is that if you don't, eventually, you will get a government who will take quite serious action on this front. Actually, the British people didn't elect Mr. Corbyn. They had a chance, in which case I think he would have probably gone for rather more redistributionist policies. But we are in a strange world in that respect. And I don't actually see much sign of any government actually dealing with those distributional consequences of QE, which I personally think is a bit of a pity.
Yeah, I think an interesting area close to lots of people's hearts is house prices and house price inflation. Low interest rates and government policies seem to have juiced the market. It also seems that this is causing intergenerational problems. Do you think the government has a deliberate policy to pump the housing market? And how long can this policy go on for?
I do think successive governments have generally supported the people who have houses over those who don't. So you've seen a number of interventions which have, in a sense, supported demand, Help to Buy, for example. For the last 40 years, we've had a whole lot of tax policy decisions which have effectively ensured that housing is taxed less than other assets. So you have, capital gains tax exemption on your main residence. There used to be the domestic rates, which are quite a good proxy for a tax on housing wealth, but they got replaced by the council tax. And the council tax hasn't been revalued for 30 years now, which just means that the tax you pay bears very little relationship to the size of your housing wealth. And I do, and then from time to time, the government will do things like sort of have stamp duty. I mean, stamp duty, incidentally, is a very poor tax. It discourages people from moving. It clogs up the housing market. So the government then, from time to time, introduces stamp duty holidays, which just have an impact of pushing up prices even more. So I think it's fair to say that the average cost of housing over the last year has gone up more than than any stamp duty saving any first-time buyer would have made. And at the heart of the problem is that old people and people who own their houses are more likely to vote than young people and people who don't own their houses. And so it's always tempting for governments basically to try and keep this rather important constituency happy. But it does distort asset allocation. And I think actually it results in a more inefficient economy. I mean, if people are more likely to invest in housing than in, you know, real activity, then you're not going to get the investment you need in productive assets in the economy. And to that extent, I think Britain has always contrasted with places like Germany, who don't have endemic housing booms. But I don't really blame the politicians. I kind of blame all of us. We, you know, we're stuck in this extraordinary embrace that we're all addicted to consumption and housing inflation. We elect politicians who give us more of it. And then we, those of us who have housing, sit around a dinner table congratulating ourselves whilst shedding crocodile tears over our children who can't afford anything. One day this will resolve itself, but I try to persuade every chancellor I work with to do something to tax housing more and completely failed.
And productivity is an interesting part of it. What do you think the government could do to boost productivity?
Really, it means really hard. Every government claims it's about to do something about productivity, and productivity remains amazingly stable, or actually the growth is worse than it was before. Look, very simply, if the government really wants to do something about productivity, it's got to have a far more successful policy around skills. I think Britain actually has good universities. I think the top 20% of the population gets a really good education and are potentially really productive. Where I worry most is around the sort of, once you get down to say the 40th, 50th, 60th, 70th, 80th percentile, do we equip people who are coming out of school, who go into further education with the skills to be more productive? I worry about that. And actually, this isn't a new problem. Governments have been commissioning reports about skills for the last 100 years. We just haven't made much progress. So I would prioritize skills. I would also prioritise investment. As I say, I think we tend to be addicted to consumption in this country, which means that we chronically underinvest. That's partly about the state. It needs to invest sensibly and actually needs to focus on investment which has a high return. I sometimes worry that governments are too obsessed with prestige projects like High Speed 2 when just building a few and better roads might make more of a difference. And then again, I think innovation is important. You've seen that actually with coronavirus vaccines. And this has been something governments have been quite good on, which is ensuring that we support innovation and research in our universities, because I think that can make a huge difference. And if you look at where there is growth in this country, it tends to be in cities with dynamic universities. Those city regions, I think, can make a big difference. But above all, if you want to really improve productivity, you really need cross-party support. Far too often, governments come into power, they rearrange all the deck chairs, they make people reapply for jobs, they call it reform, but actually it's all rather pointless and wasteful and tends to miss the big picture. So what I'd like to see is a bit of German consensus, which really does home in on these things, because you can't change, productivity won't change 5 years. It takes 20, 25, 30 years of real persistence, real focus. And if you do that, you might just raise the productivity rate by about 0.25% over and above what it would have grown by anyway. But it's definitely worth doing.
You said earlier you think the government will need to raise some taxes to help get the debt under control. How do you see the trade-off between tax rises and economic growth?
Well, I think it very much depends on which taxes you choose and how they impact on the economy. So, for example, the one tax the government has agreed on is a whopping great increase in the rate of corporation tax, the taxes on business. Now, that's a really easy tax to raise because, you know, corporations aren't individuals, so, you know, no one really notices it. Now, it may be justified because other countries are raising their corporation tax rates too, but I would be very worried if the government just simply carried on piling more and more taxes on business, because in the end, that will probably result in less investment and make Britain a less attractive place to do business. I think in the end, I mean, there's an issue about how much the sort of rich pay in tax compared to everybody else. It may be that there is some scope for raising taxes on the better off. And I've mentioned housing and capital gains and so on. But if you want to raise serious money, I'm afraid there's really no choice but to raise taxes in which everybody pays. It's always tempting to think that there's someone better off than you who can bear all the tax. And actually, it usually doesn't work because the better off have a terrible tendency to leave the country or to organise their affairs rather better than the government can organise theirs in terms of extracting revenue from the better off. So you do come back to basically value-added tax, income tax and national insurance. I mean, for my part, I've been advocating for a while some sort of temporary social solidarity charge, because we do have to think, if we want to spend more on things like social care, you're going to have to pay for it. And ideally, that should be paid by everybody according to in proportion to their incomes. But you shouldn't just focus on employment income, because there are a fair amount of rentiers and people who live off dividends and so on, and they need to pay their fair share.
There have been some reports about a possible national insurance tax rise, even though that was part of what the Conservative Party had said that they wouldn't do. Would you support that?
Well, I certainly support some sort of tax rise. I'm slightly against national insurance, because national insurance is only paid by those of us, well, for a start, it's not paid by anybody who's older than retirement age. You stop paying it when you get to pension age. And actually, there are a lot of quite wealthy, high-income people who are relatively old. I don't see why they shouldn't pay their fair share. National insurance, you're basically just taxing jobs. And I also worry that young people would end up paying rather more than they should if you go down that route. So I'd like to see a more broadly based income charge. But before you think I'm some sort of headbanger who just wants to tax everybody, I really much prefer not to. And I do think we have to have quite a sort of grown-up conversation about public spending, what we spend our money on. And we are going to have to spend rather less, I suspect.
Have you pitched your social solidarity charge to the government? Have you had a response from them?
Well, I've been sort of pitching it in a slightly hapless way for some years. And occasionally I read articles in the FT about what the government's planning to do. I may have had some influence. I rather doubt it, because certainly the government's never asked me for my opinion, and I can't really blame them.
Okay, so you said we need to get spending under control. Modern monetary theory has been gathering momentum. They would argue that it doesn't matter what you spend, you can get it in tax. The debt doesn't matter. What is your response to modern monetary theorists?
Like everything which tells you can have something for nothing, I'm just a little bit suspicious. Look, in the short run, the government can carry on borrowing. I'm not disputing that. You know, at the moment, long-term interest rates remain stubbornly low, and that's good. And if ever there's a time the government should be investing, it's now, because you can borrow for 40 years at something like 1% and a bit. So I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just saying, if you're going to fund consumption now by ever-increasing borrowing, just carrying on, spend, in the end, there will be consequences. There will be higher inflation. There will be potentially a devaluation of sterling. And actually, the cost of borrowing will go up, because it comes back to my point that unless the central bank's going to carry on buying the debt, someone has to buy it. And if the value of that debt keeps falling because of inflation, people aren't going to want to hold it. So I think there's a balance to be struck. I'm not claiming we need to go into full-on austerity. I'm just saying you need a plan to at least stabilize debt in relation to GDP. And I do think it's slightly misleading the public, this idea that you can just spend with impunity. You can't.
As part of my research for this, I came across something that you had said in 2019, and I'll paraphrase. Economic crises are in part owing to governments and institutions holding on to outdated ideas and applying them in a somewhat unthinking way, even though the situation has changed. What did you mean by this? And dare I even say it, if you had to guess, what do you think the next crisis might be?
There's a tendency there's a wonderful quote from Keynes about people hanging on to outdated theories. You get long cycles in economic policy where the conventional wisdom changes. But in changing, there's a tendency to throw out all the lessons of the past. So you mentioned modern monetary theory. Modern monetary theory is kind of a response to perhaps governments being overly obsessed about things like deficits and debts. I get that. And I think probably looking back on it, the Treasury may have been overly concerned about the growth in the debt round about the 2010 period. But the risk is you sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater, and you just think that you can do precisely the opposite of what you always thought in the past, and somehow it will all work out fine. And nearly always, in my view, a crisis happens. You spend a lot of time sort of trying to understand why that crisis happened. And then you spend, you know, the next sort of 10, 20 years effectively refighting the last war. You become so obsessed with what triggered the last crisis that you just try and do everything to ensure it's not repeated. But in doing that, you often sow the seeds of the next crisis. So I don't know what will cause the next crisis. You know, it'll be almost certainly something which neither you nor I have mentioned during the course of this conversation. I mean, who would have guessed? Well, actually, quite a few people did guess, but that, you know, a massive pandemic would have triggered the extraordinary events of last year. What I concluded, actually, after many years of working in the Treasury, is that it's less important to you know, have a crystal ball and spend your time predicting the future, because none of us can predict the future. But what is more important is that we kind of develop a sort of agile states of mind, that actually when bad things happen, we kind of are well placed to adapt to them, to think the unthinkable, take the odd risk, and not become prisoners of some outdated economic orthodoxy.
I guess one thing that has really changed over the past century is globalization and the interconnectivity of economies. Just wondering, from your experience at the Treasury, to what extent does decision making depend on the activity or influences of other countries, such as the US and maybe increasingly China?
Well, a huge amount. I mean, Britain is a very open economy. It's very dependent on trade in primarily in services, actually, rather than goods, and can't exist in isolation. You know, we do contrast with the United States, which actually, to a large extent, even now, is a relatively closed economy. Trade does not account for much of American output, whereas it's very different in Britain. I mean, the other point I'd make on that is we are far more dependent on international capital markets. Countries like Japan and Italy have huge domestic savings. The British people have never been very interested in saving. So we depend, as Mark Carney once put it, on the kindness of strangers to buy our government debt. And that also has implications. So, I mean, what conclusions do I draw from this? That international cooperation is really important. Sadly, there's not been much of it about in recent years, but I think the Biden administration does seem to want to use, you know, the classic international fora like the G7, the G20, the IMF, World Bank, and so on, to ensure greater international cooperation. That's good, and it's important. Most of the time, it's not that important. These things can be talking shops, but when things start going wrong, working together is really important. And actually, one of Gordon Brown's greatest successes was during the banking crisis, was actually working really hard with, you know, Obama and Merkel and Sarkozy to look at this in from a global perspective. So, I mean, one thing which has worried me a bit in recent years, I mean, at least Mr. Trump has now disappeared from the scene, is I think if we all retreat into national policy making and trade barriers and so on, we do risk undermining the success of globalization. I'm not claiming that globalization has been brilliant from everybody's point of view, but free trade, in my view, is really central to greater global prosperity. And I would hope that at some point we can reinvigorate multilateral institutions like the World Trade Organization to try and reduce trade barriers rather than to increase them.
I feel like I have to ask about Brexit now. What are your thoughts on the economic implications of Brexit in the long term?
Well, I mean, my views on Brexit haven't really changed. There's absolutely no reason why outside the European Union, Britain can't be really successful, but it does have to pursue sensible economic policies. And one of those is around trade barriers. I do worry a bit about the sort of relationship we have with the European Union now, that there are greater trade barriers than there were before. And any trade barrier is going to have an impact on economic activity. So I am confident that in the long run, our relationship with Europe will settle down. At the moment, you know, the politics of Brexit just mean that everybody gets very angry about everything. And so we're seeing this dispute about the Northern Ireland protocol and so on. I do think in the end, the people who have dominated the Conservative Party on Brexit and have sort of been a bit like sort of French revolutionaries in a way in pushing it ever more in the direction of a harder Brexit. In the end, this will all settle down and we will end up in rather softer territory where Britain will continue to trade sensibly with the European Union. We were never properly in the European Union. We were never part of the Schengen area. We were never in the Euro. I think we will settle down in a new equilibrium where we're outside the European Union, but we have very close relationships with it. That, I think, still remains some way off, but I just think the pendulum will swing. In the meanwhile, yes, Britain's economy will probably grow slightly less rapidly than it otherwise would, but I don't expect anybody to notice it because we're just talking about something like sort of 0.2% a year. I mean, I wouldn't notice a 0.2% change in my income, so I don't expect the British people will notice it. I mean, personally, I think it's a pity. I would have preferred to stay in the European Union, but we lost that argument, and it's time to move on. And I'm trying my best to move on.
Great. Well, let's hope your outlook proves to be right. There's so much more I want to ask you about, but I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate your time.